You're listening to Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross, who is off today. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Carolyn Osorio has your news today. Of course, you just heard from Sully. 17 years into the war, Afghanistan is still a dangerous place for Americans and anyone who appears to be an ally. Let's bring in CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Good morning, Jeff.
Colleen, good morning to you.
So the it sounds like the U.S. general or commander, excuse me, he escaped harm, three Americans wounded, but a very important ally in Afghanistan was killed. What can you tell us about this attack?
Well, there's no doubt about it, Colleen. This was one of the most devastating assassination attacks, perhaps in the entire history of this particular war. It occurred inside the compound of the provincial governor of Kandahar, southern province of Afghanistan. And in this particular case, an insider attack by one of the guards of the governor, as they were moving towards a helicopter, he opened fire on General Austin and the regional police chief, General Abdul Razik, killing the provincial intelligence officer, also wounding the governor and a couple of other Afghans, unclear their particular status. Luckily, General Miller did, in fact, escape uninjured. But as you say, three Americans were wounded in the process.
This gunman was wearing an Afghan army uniform. Was he allowed on base, or did he slip on simply because he looked like he should be there?
A little unclear at this particular moment, but we have seen these so-called blue-on-blue attacks, unfortunately, happening throughout Afghanistan at various times. And it's either the case that someone was able to infiltrate and by some way get a uniform and gain access, or more likely, they had been a member of the Guard, but over time had become somehow a way recruited by the Taliban to conduct an attack like this.
17 years of this war, you say this is one of the worst targeted assassinations in the war's history. At this point, what is our footprint in Afghanistan and the state of the Taliban?
Well, we have about 15,000 troops. In addition to that, there's around 3,000 or so NATO forces also supporting our efforts in Afghanistan. But at the moment, of course, the Taliban Afghan government only controls about 50% of the provinces of the country. About 20% are controlled by the Taliban. The rest are kind of up for grabs. But over the last year or two, we've basically seen a drift in success towards the Taliban. There can be no doubt about that, as they are able to secure more and more territory. And at the same time, the Afghan military and police are sustaining such significant casualties, most people would argue this is unsustainable in manpower terms. And this attack, of course, occurs the day before Afghan national elections, which are supposed to occur on Saturday. But to show you how that affects those, only one-third of the polling stations in Afghanistan will open because of Taliban control of other areas. And now all of the polling stations in Kandahar in the aftermath of this particular attack are closed for the elections.
Mm. 17 years. How have we and our allies not been able to get a stronger hold on Afghanistan over the Taliban?
Well, I think the real reason is because we have to present a viable alternative. And unfortunately, despite all our efforts, despite trillions of dollars that the United States has spent on Afghanistan, we have been able to create a political structure that is an alternative that the Afghan people will very, very energetically embrace. Most of them, I think, at this point, largely are reaching towards absolute exhaustion. Secondly, of course, is the problem of Pakistan. As we used to say when I was in the region, you know, we can lose the war in Afghanistan, we can only win the war in Pakistan. And as long as the Taliban are able to use safe havens in Pakistan, many believe receive support through Pakistan, some even believe from the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, then it's going to be very difficult for us, combining those two things, to in fact gain a military victory. As a consequence, every military leader I've talked to says that the future now is a political solution, some kind of negotiations between, at the beginning, the United States and the Taliban, and hopefully ultimately then bringing in the Afghan government.
And who would be responsible for steering that political solution?
Well, right now, the President of the United States has named former Ambassador Zal Khalilzad to be our envoy, but those have gotten off to kind of a shaky start. Last week, Master Khalilzad, met with Taliban leaders in Qatar to begin talks on talks, discussing a framework for negotiation. This was a major concession because for years we had argued we would not meet with the Taliban unless the Afghan government was also present They argued they wanted bilateral negotiations solely with the U.S., saying that the Afghan government was, in effect, a puppet. But we eventually got the Afghan government to agree to let us go ahead, though there are now reports that President Ghani of Afghanistan was somewhat infuriated or blindsided by this most recent meeting by Khalilzad, which may mean our allies are estranged from us. And, of course, following this particular attack, one wonders what effect that will have on future meetings between the United States and Taliban representatives.
Based on what you know, your experience, are we there for another 17 years?
It's very possible this, and many people talk about this, becoming not unlike our presence in Korea, though obviously quite a bit more violent. We see, of course, in Korea that the United States basically sits where the Korean War ended in 1953, and here we are some 65 years later with about 28,000 U.S. forces in Korea. Now, of course, they're not in combat, and over time we have been able to create and help create a very effective democracy in South Korea. The problem is, though that metaphor sounds interesting, Afghanistan is a very difficult place, certainly based on the economic and political situation. And then geographically, of course, though Pakistan is a difficult part of the problem, Pakistan has to be part of the solution, if for no other reason than geographically everything just about that goes into Afghanistan to support our efforts has to cross either Pakistani airspace or Pakistani territory.
Boy. CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Colleen.
It's been a busy week in Washington, D.C. Is it ever not a busy week in Washington, D.C.? Let's go right to the White House and CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy. During a rally in Montana last night, Stephen, President Trump celebrated a Republican congressman's assault on a reporter.
Greg is smart. And by the way, never wrestle him. You understand that? Never. Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind.
Stephen, remind us which Greg the president's talking about here.
Yeah, it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt. He's talking about Greg Gianforte, the Republican congressman who represents the entire state of Montana in the House. Last year, it wasn't even a year and a half ago, Gianforte was in a special election to fill the seat of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. And a reporter from The Guardian named Ben Jacobs was at Gianforte's campaign headquarters and wanted to ask him a question about the Affordable Care Act. Well, Gianforte didn't like it and threw the man to the ground and broke his glasses and punched him. Now, for this, Gianforte admitted his guilt. He pleaded guilty to misdemeanor assault. He performed community service. He paid a fine. He had to repeatedly explain his actions and apologize for them. He made a donation to the Committee to Protect Journalists. And all of this was behind him until last night when the president focused renewed attention on the attack. Really is what it was, in May of 2017, and the president laughed it off and essentially cheered Gianforte for attacking a journalist. His campaign opponent in this current election cycle is trying to make or has alluded to the attack in her campaign ads, but despite that, Gianforte is favored to win re-election to the House, to a full his first full term in the House. And the president tried to laugh it off last night. This, of course, happening at the same time as the president is promising severe consequences for Saudi Arabia if the Saudis find themselves to be responsible for the death of a writer and critic of the Saudi kingdom, Jamal Khashoggi. And we're waiting on some kind of a statement that the president says is coming from the United States on that.
And this seeming glee from the assault on a reporter comes just days after the president told Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes that the attack on Jamal Khashoggi was disgusting, particularly because he's a journalist. And you hear that and you go, oh, good, he gets it. But then you hear at the rally last night and you see his supporters cheering the assault of a reporter and you go, you can't take any of what the president says seriously because of this back and forth, this almost emotional abuse of what he says.
Well, there's no doubt that it's inconsistent. And as I said off the top, you know, it's all fun and games until someone gets hurt. And so it is what it is. We are where we are. And, you know, unfortunately for Gianforte, you know, he thought that this had been put behind him last year. Well, now this is going to open up a whole new round of conversations about the incident, about what he did, about how he had to plead guilty and apologize for it. And the president is trying to laugh it off. And look, the voters of Montana are likely to send this man back to the House of Representatives. Yeah. That's their right, their choice. But it does raise questions about all of this in the wake of what we're dealing with Saudi Arabia.
And what is the latest on that investigation? Because I've seen a very slow evolution in the president and his administration's reaction to the, I guess, suspected murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
Well, the White House has given, at the request of the Secretary of State, more time to the Saudis to complete their own investigation. The president said yesterday that he is waiting on the results of that investigation, as well as a Turkish investigation and perhaps another that he hadn't disclosed or specified. He said there are about three different investigations, and once those are completed, we should be making a very strong statement. He was asked if consequences would have to fall upon Saudi Arabia. He said yes, it'd be very severe, that what happened to Jamal Khashoggi was very bad stuff. And until we have something more concrete, that's what we have to go on for now.
And the members of Congress, Republicans in particular, who at first came out very strong against Saudi Arabia, haven't heard from them much in recent days. Are they waiting to see what the president does?
Well, look, you have some Republicans who are saying that there's no excuse for what happened, that severe consequences have to fall upon the Saudis. There are some Republicans, some of them elected to Congress, others on the periphery and in conservative media, who are trying to, at the moment, give the president some cover if he should decide not to impose severe consequences on a country that the president talks about as an important strategic ally and also a customer of the United States and its defense sector. The conservatives that I'm talking about are reported in the Washington Post to be engaging in a whisper campaign about how Jamal Khashoggi, in addition to being a critic of the Saudi kingdom and a columnist for the Washington Post, was also early in his life in some way connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, as if to say that that should matter. But it is something that they've been talking about and suggesting that that undue attention has perhaps been drawn to this incident. It's one thing the president actually said yesterday in an interview with the New York Times. He said that this has caught the imagination of the world and taken on a bigger life than it would normally take on. Mm. I'm not sure what he means by that exactly, as if to say that if the Saudis had dismembered someone in their own consulate in Istanbul, that otherwise perhaps wouldn't care, but for the fact that it was someone who was working for the Washington Post and Owen happened to live in Virginia.
All right. CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Always good talking to you, Stephen.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and here he is, movie man Michael Medved, to prepare us for Halloween. And so remind me about this franchise and where this movie comes in the franchise.
Okay, this is the 11th Halloween movie. I mean, that's a lot. The original movie came out in 1978. John Carpenter, it was a movie that cost almost nothing. John Carpenter wrote it and directed it, and he wrote the music, and the music is back. He's again done the music for this film 40 years later, and it's one of the effective parts of this film. A lot of people remember the original Halloween, which was a very, very effective film. It was creepy, it was scary, it started a whole trend of slasher/horror movies. And Mike Myers, or Michael Myers, the evil psycho who may or may not be something supernatural, the boogeyman, comes up on Halloween Eve and he kills a bunch of babysitters. The one babysitter he tries to kill but fails to kill is named Laurie Strode, who's played by Jamie Lee Curtis. That was her debut role 40 years ago. Jamie Lee Curtis is back.
She is back.
One of the people who played Michael Myers, who is a shape wearing a mask, is back. John Carpenter is back, not as a director this time, but as a film composer and as one of the producers. And the franchise is back.
Laurie, we saw him. We met with Michael. I showed him the mask. It was nothing. No response, nothing. He won't talk to anyone. Never has. But I think he might speak with you.
Let me just say flat out, this film has absolutely no right to be as good as it is. It's a very well-made film, creepy as hell. It is impossible not to feel disturbed, frightened, on edge.
Why do people pay for that?
You know, I
can get that by turning on the radio.
I was asking myself the same question when I was coming out of the film, because I don't like slasher films, okay? I mean, I've written about it a lot. I don't think it's really good for the culture. I don't think it's good for individuals seeing them. However, there is an artistry there.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons people like it and they go to it is because when you are caught up in some of the tension, you kind of forget about, you know, what you have to do when you get home. You're forgetting about, that bill that I have to pay or whatever I have to do. You are just in there in the moment, and film can do that. And this film does it well.
Michael Myers is a human being who killed his sister when he was 6 years old. And he came after you. We just want to know why. We want a glimpse inside his mind.
Michael Myers murdered 5 people. And he's a human being we need to understand.
They're transferring him.
Tomorrow, 7 o'clock.
Yeah, he'll be locked away until the end of his days.
That's the idea.
And by the way, one of the things that also this film picks up is John Carpenter was very obviously, in terms of his shot selection and the way he made his original film, inspired by Hitchcock in Psycho.
And so Hitchcock never grossed you out.
No. And this doesn't either.
Ah, really?
No. The film understands the most frightful impact you can have on a viewer is forcing them to use their imagination.
Right, what you don't see.
You see a bunch of teeth on the floor. And then you have to think about, oh my God, where do they come? And it's thinking about that that's scary. There's a lot of the most grotesque violence in this film. You actually hear things, but all the actual violence is happening behind a closed door. You're looking through an open door, and they're in another part of the room.
Michael's here. Get downstairs. Go, baby, go!
The guy who made this film, David Gordon Green, has a writing partner for virtually all of his films named Danny McBride, who apparently helped to write this thing. And kudos to them in making a Halloween movie. As I say, if you don't like slasher movies, there is not a chance in the world that my wife would ever see 30 seconds
Diane
of this
film. Diane
does
not like these
no,
movies.
She hates it.
You
she
have
thinks
to go
it's bad for you. Right. So this is brutal, punishing, difficult work, but somebody's got to do it.
and bless you for that, Michael.
No, but for people who have liked any of the Halloween series, this is without question the one that comes closest to the effectiveness for what it is and the artistry of the original film. And one of the other interesting things about watching this film, you're reminded of how good as a film composer John Carpenter was. Very few directors. Clint Eastwood sometimes would write scores for his own films that he directed. But the film score is very effective. Well done. 3 stars. It is very much rated R. If you don't think you like slasher films, don't see it. But as slasher films go, this is almost as good as it gets.
Right. Well, what America needs is another film to raise its level of paranoia. So,
well, especially, I mean, by the way, the victim here, no victims named Khashoggi. But
that's true.
You know, you talk about slasher films. That's what we're hearing in the news about that Saudi case.
I know.
In Turkey. It's worse than anything in Halloween.
Okay, well, I'm not sure whether to be reassured by that or...
Just wait for the movie.
Yeah. Michael Medved, thank you.
You bet, Dave.
It's time for our Sports Insider now from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. You can hear Danny O'Neill weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and More. Today at 3, you can hear Danny in Coogtown.
That's exactly right. I'm going to be in Pullman.
Wow.
I'm going to be loading up the Sprinter van. I'm going to be leaving right after
You're
we talk.
You're sprinting there.
Yeah, I think I'll be able to make it at normal rate. We should be arriving in town about 1 o'clock.
Except Sully says there's a detour. He's going to tell us about that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. I want to know your predictions for this game because the atmosphere is going to be out of this world. I think during the break I mentioned it's going to be like a Seahawks CenturyLink field down in Pullman.
Yes, you're going to have... This is a very hard ticket to get. Coug fans have been waiting 15 years for mm-hmm. game day to come there. And you talk to people, they've been to two Rose Bowls recently. And Jim Moore, who is Captain Coug, in my opinion, says this feels like a bigger regular season game than they had in any of those seasons because of the attention, because of the focus. I think it's going to be a great atmosphere. I think Wazoo's a really good team. It'll also help Washington if Wazoo wins.
How's that?
Because it gives Washington control of its own destiny in the Pac-12 North.
You're going to have to explain this to me.
If Washington, if the Cougs win tomorrow and yeah. Washington wins out because the Cougs and Washington still play head-to-head, Washington would win the division and then play for the Pac-12 Conference Championship.
Hmm.
If the Ducks beat the Cougs tomorrow, Washington would need someone else to knock off Oregon to have a chance to win the division.
You say Wazoo's a great team.
Yes.
Is this going to be a close game then, or is it?
I think so.
Oh.
I mean, this is, Washington had a better defense than Washington State does, so it might be easier for the Ducks to score, but Washington State has a significantly better offense than Washington did. And that the Washington-Oregon game was back and forth, two very, very evenly matched teams, I felt. I thought if you play that game 100 times, I don't think you have either team winning more than 60% of the time. Just it was very well played. And I think that this game, while different, is going to be also pretty evenly matched. You're going to have two teams. I think it'll be higher scoring. I think both teams could get in the 40s. But I'll be really interested to see how this goes.
Are you heading out there, Sully? That's your team.
No, because my son's got a football game tonight. And
that
he's,
takes precedent
so
over
we
the
got
tickets are like $700.
Yeah, I know.
That's what they're going for in the secondary market. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be a really good game. I mean, Oregon, their defense is not as good in the secondary, which is what Wazoo's going to exploit. So I'm expecting, I don't know which way it's going to go. It should be another fun game. The atmosphere is going to be ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great day to be in Pullman. So I don't know which way it's going to go either.
What's this going to bring to the school after game day leaves?
What should the attention and excitement that's there? This is a program that when Mike Leach took it over was at a rock bottom point. And it's come back to a consistently ranked, consistently bowl eligible team. And now you've got a shot where, hey, this is a team that could play for a conference championship. I think that the momentum and excitement that's there with that will carry over, and it'll help because they're going to have a new quarterback after this season. Mm-hmm. Gardner Minshew, who's there now as a transfer, I think he's the best quarterback in the conference, and I think Oregon's quarterback is second best.
You think the Cougs need help with confidence?
Yeah, they do.
What?
The Cougs are our little brother. Like you.
You're too kind.
No.
I mean, they're the noisy, I mean, in a good way, fans, tried and true. They bring their flags at Mount Everest. You see the Coug flag everywhere. What is it called? Old Crimson?
Yeah, because they don't have anything better
to
do.
And you think the takeaway from game day is that's going to boost their confidence?
Yes. The Cougs need to feel good about themselves. The Washington Huskies have beat them like 120-30 over the past 3 years.
So you're coming from a Husky perspective.
That's exactly right. Okay. I hope it makes them feel, it bolsters their confidence. I want little brother to succeed. Okay. I really do.
Then you're going to give him a noogie or a wedgie right after,
right? Well, when it comes down to it, I think most of us know how that usually sorts itself out.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit of every satisfaction that I feel over a victory over the Cougs is mixed with a little bit of pity.
Let's talk about the Seahawks have a bye week. The NFC West, how's that shaping up? Because the Rams are dominant.
The Rams are. The division's weird. They have maybe two of the five worst teams. San Francisco and Arizona are god-awful. Arizona was down. The score was 35-3 at one point last night. It was awful. They looked horrible. They had their rookie quarterback in. He was intercepted. Had two interceptions returned for a touchdown in the first quarter last night. They're awful. San Francisco should be better, but their quarterback got hurt, so they're really awful. And that's really sad because their quarterback's really, really good-looking.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's a very good-looking man.
Does that play
man.
A part in athletic ability?
Some people think that your quarterback, having a good-looking quarterback, helps. A little more confidence for him, you know? No, but he's been hurt. He's been their running backs. So you've got two of the five worst teams in the league, in my opinion. And then you've got maybe the best team in the league in the Rams.
Where'd that come from?
Yeah, they were building that momentum last year, and they kind of took a page out of Seattle's book, which is you've got a quarterback, a cost-controlled quarterback, and you go out and make a bunch of big-budget additions right now, big-budget short-term additions. They are loaded up. They're 6-0. I don't think they'll go undefeated, but the idea, I have a hard time thinking that they won't win the division pretty handily. And that leaves Seattle chasing one of the two wild card spots. It helps. You've got two bad opponents, which means those are four fairly winnable games, and the Seahawks have already won one of them. But you don't really, if you were in any other division, you could think, hey, maybe we'll get the division title. And that's not realistic in the Seahawks division.
All right, Danny, thank you. Good luck on your journey to Pullman.
Thanks. I'll drive safe.
We'll see you Monday. Yes, please.
Go Cougs.
Go Cougs. I never thought I'd hear you say that.
And we're coming.
If only you guys could see Sully dancing right now. He didn't go anywhere. He's back because he's got a bonus choke point for us. ESPN Game Day Edition. It's brought to you by Online Trading Academy. 15 years of waiting for Game Day to show up in Pullman. It ends this weekend. Nearly every Coug is planning on making the trip. And that is going to be challenging to get to the Palouse. Tell us why, Sully.
Yeah, it is. I mean, because driving to Pullman from the Seattle area, I never really considered it a fun experience, just because it's a long drive. And, you know, if you got a lot of people there, it could take, like, it's a five-hour drive. It's
you kinda, don't play I Spy?
No, well, you know, in certain spots along that way, because of all the farmland you go through, there isn't a lot to, you
I
know,
still
look
enjoy
at.
Reading the little labels, like potatoes, alfalfa.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, but, you know, one of those things, if you've got younger kids in the car or whatever, a long drive could be like that could be kind of a pain. But anyway, the roads are dark also if you're going at off-hour. It can be
dangerous.
Kind of monotonous as well. The main route, of course, is I-90 to Highway 26 to 195. It's about a 295-mile trip. And now you add every Cougar that you can imagine on that same path.
Sure, anyone knows for sure how many people are heading to this game, but certainly there's a lot of enthusiasm. People have been waiting a long time for this game day broadcast out of Pullman, and I think pretty much every Cougar alum is either going or knows someone who is.
Barbara LeBeau with the Washington Department of Transportation says this will not be your normal trip to Pullman. Those rural highways were not designed to handle the kind of traffic that is expected for everybody who's heading over to game day. I mean, not just, I mean, a normal weekend for the game is one thing. Then you add all the people that are going there for the experience. So you need to plan for a long drive, and you even if you're going at odd hours. I mean, game day starts at 6 a.m. on Saturday.
What?
Yeah, because the East Coast broadcast starts at 9 for the kickoff of the East Coast games at noon, which is 9 o'clock our time.
Okay.
So people are going to start lining up at 2, 3 o'clock in the morning for this thing. That's the way it happens, yes, having been to several game day broadcasts. LeBeau says you should expect traffic at no matter what time of day you're going.
We think we're going to see a lot of overnight traffic and a lot of really early morning traffic. Larger volumes than normal at those times of day. So, you know, normally like at 2 in the morning, there's not a lot of traffic on state routes. And we think here there might be for people coming in trying to make that broadcast.
And that's also pretty dangerous because, as I said, those roads are very dark. There's not a lot of lighting on them. If you're not familiar with those roads, too, going in the dark, it could be some issues. Compounding the drive this week is a brand new construction project on Highway 26 just east of Othello. The highway's actually closed for bridge repairs.
That started this Monday. It was planned before anyone knew about game day. And because we're racing the winter, we can't really delay that.
There's a detour in place. It's about a 30-mile detour. You have to go south and then to Highway 117 and then up 395. It should add at least 15, 20 minutes to your trip, even without any extra traffic that you're dealing with. And LeBeau says you need to be prepared for a Crimson Caravan. No matter when it is that you're heading over.
What we don't want is people thinking that they can get there in their normal travel time and then getting caught in a backup and A, missing what's going to be a fun experience, and then B, getting frustrated and possibly, you know, doing something reckless and causing problems along the way.
And with kickoff set for 4:30 tomorrow afternoon, a lot of fans might spend the night over there on the east side. So that means your get back traffic on I-90 is going to be much worse than usual on a Sunday. Even if you're not heading to Pullman this weekend for this activity and for the game and for game day, you should expect more traffic on any of your east-west route across the state. Just be prepared. It's going to be a long drive for you.
Have you heard from anyone who's made that trip and taken the detour?
I didn't talk to. I know some people who took it yesterday, mm-hmm. And I didn't hear back as whether or not that caused them any big issues getting over there. I think the later we go into the day, with more and more people probably heading over there today than yesterday, that kind of detour is going to cause some issues.
Well, if that's
for
the case,
you.
Then why wouldn't you just detour most people to the Spokane to Pullman route?
Well, because that's going to be a longer route too. I mean, granted, you'd be on I-90 for much more extended period of time, mm-hmm. but then those roads heading south out of Spokane down through Pullman. you know, can't handle that kind of traffic either. But I mean, that might not be a bad way to go anyway, just to give yourself a little bit more of a freeway speed drive to get to the east and then a little bit more crush as you get down to the south.
Stop at Zips and Ripsville, get yourself a burger and fries.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are options. You don't have to take that 26-to-1, you know, drive there, the normal drive there, if you don't want to. But that's just the fastest way, even with this detour. But yeah, just plan ahead and know that, I mean, even if you're going to think you're going to go, okay, I'm sleeping all day today and I'm going to leave at midnight and I'm going to get there at 4 a.m., you're going to have a lot of company on the road. At least that's what the state's expecting.
Good to know. Thank you for that bonus choke point.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, I hope everybody enjoys game day. It's a heck of experience. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I can hear the, I mean, I'm a Husky and all that stuff. I know a lot of Cougs, spent some time in Spokane, but I can feel the excitement. It's genuine. I'm happy for them. It's a big deal. Pressure mounting for the Seattle City Council to approve a long-awaited police contract. Police officers in Seattle have been waiting for years for a contract, and everything seemed to be buttoned up. The union was happy, the police chief was happy, the mayor was happy, and then the Community Police Commission came in and said, wait a second, this contract may violate reforms that were ordered by the Justice Department, and they're encouraging the Seattle City Council to vote no on the contract. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott ran into the police chief this morning here at our studios to see what she had to say about it. Hannah?
So as you said, the mayor thought this was a done deal when she announced that she had sent it to the city council on Monday. She was all full of confidence and said it was long overdue.
Our officers who work to protect us day in, day out, have been working without a contract, a pay raise, or even a cost of living adjustment since 2014. No worker, and particularly those who protect us, should go without a pay raise for that long.
As you said, the Community Police Commission threw a wrench in that 2 days later and said, we've got issues with this. We think it rolls back reforms. We are going to unanimously recommend to the council that they reject this. That surprised a lot of people, including Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best, who tells Jason Rance on our sister station KTTH that this does not roll back any reforms.
Everything about it is fair and provides fair compensation to the officers who are working hard day in and day out. And we are committed to reform. Listen, we were declared in full and effective compliance. We didn't even have a contract. Right? The officers are doing the work and they deserve the pay and they deserve fair compensation for it. And nothing about any of the negotiations sets us back on reform in any way.
So where's the disconnect between what the mayor and Chief Best are saying about the contract not rolling back reforms and what the Community Police Commission is saying?
The people who are responsible, though, to make sure that the contract goes through is the city council. And while everybody is entitled to their opinion about, you know, what they see or don't see in the contract, it's the city council's responsibility to approve the contract.
Yeah. So the buck lies with the city council, not the Community Police Commission, was my takeaway from that. Chief Best says it is absolutely vital, though, that the council approve this contract.
And I have to tell you that we need to have this contract go through. We are not going to be able to provide effective public safety, in my opinion, unless we fairly compensate the officers. Too many officers will leave. They've worked too hard. No one should expect the workers. They don't expect nurses or teachers or anyone else to work without a contract. Why should the officers have to do that when they're working so hard?
So she says public safety is on the line here. Those big, all important staffing numbers that we hear about all the time on the line here. The city council needs a supermajority to approve this contract, which means 7 of 9 of the council members. Right now, the police guild tells me that council members Sawant, O'Brien, and Herbold are all no votes. So that's an issue. The city council itself has not responded to any of my requests for council member positions on this contract. And these requests, by the way, that I started making even before the Community Police Commission came out with that urging the no vote. So
that's nice transparency from our city council.
Yeah, no comment whatsoever, despite repeated requests from me as well as Jason Rance. And at a budget session on SPD yesterday, many of us expected that the council was going to address the issue during that meeting. Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez started that meeting by saying they would not be talking about it during that session. Chief Best was asked whether a no vote from the council would be a sign that the council doesn't have the SPD's back.
I think that saying no to this contract would be a big mistake. I believe that the officers, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, they deserve fair compensation for the work that they're doing and have continued to do over the past four mayors until our current mayor said, actually help with the leadership to make sure that we get this thing through. So the officers deserve the compensation. The council needs to pass this.
And as she exited Jason Rand's studio, I chased her out the door and I asked her for her message to the city council.
Well, if I had to say anything to the city council, it would be, you know, that we want them to really do the right thing and do what's right by the officers.
So Sawant, O'Brien, Herbold, in your past experience with them, have they ever been swayed to change their vote?
I think there's certainly a possibility that you could get Lisa Herbold in the yes column for sure.
And then they'd have the supermajority.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I would say no on the Sawant. I think she's kind of a given. Not sure on O'Brien.
And the Community Police Commission, they have really no authority over the approval of this contract. They can just make recommendations. But they've also, in my reading, threatened to bring a federal judge into this matter to put a stop to this.
Yeah, and they could ask federal judge. I believe they'd ask Judge Robart, who oversees the police reforms, the consent decree. They could ask him for an injunction. I've not heard for sure if they were going to do that. And, you know, this is all tied in with the overall budget that needs to be passed still as well. So there's a lot going on here. One can be the SPD contract or the budget. Both can be passed without the other. They're supposed to be passed simultaneously.
One can be assured that Hannah Scott will get to the bottom of this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hannah.